Martinez is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Virgil Martinez in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host, Gray Hill. Legal analyst, Jim Skelton. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dennis Longmire. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. And special guest, Kristen Houlet, executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. The Execution Watch begins.
This is Ray Hill, and I am the... we've got the music coming on top of us. Okay, we get that. And I'm sorry. This is Ray Hill, and you're listening to Execution Watch. If you're tuning to KPFT HD Channel 2, we're glad to have you out there. If you're listening over the internet at executionwatch.org, you might share that email or that website address with your friends so that we can have more people. We do this every time Texas executes someone. It's very serious business in Texas, and there's a lot of business executing people in Texas. And every time there's an execution at 6 o'clock, we come into this studio and do a live program about that execution. We discuss the history of the case, we discuss the legal history of the case, and we bring you whatever information that we can have, and usually include a special guest or two to talk about the issue of executions in Texas. We are volunteers here. Radio station KPFT is a listener-sponsored radio station. You can learn more about that off of its website, kpft.org. And you can listen to this show on a link from that website, as well as a link from theprisonshow.org. And so right now, what is happening is our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, is out there dialing for Dennis Longmire. He is a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University, and he whenever he's in town, joins a group of people holding vigil about executions outside the death chamber. And Elizabeth is now in the studio, and we haven't gotten Dennis on the air, but she's still working on it. And so when we get Dennis, we'll be ready. Dennis, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, Dennis. Hello, Dennis. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, tell us what's going on in Huntsville.
Okay, there are 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 of us here on the corner now, and we are all waiting with great hope because no one has yet crossed the street going into the building to witness the execution, which is always a good sign come 6 o'clock because normally they've already crossed the street.
Would you tell our listening audience tonight all of the symbolism in crossing the street? What actually happens there?
Certainly. What happens prior to the execution is the witnesses for the media and witnesses for the family of the condemned cross the street, and they only come across the street after all appeals have been denied, and actually even after the condemned has been strapped onto the execution gurney. And so the fact that they have not yet come across is a sign to us that the execution is still on hold. Of course, two people here on the corner are related to Virgil Martinez, tonight's victim, and they have word that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals still has the case. We are hopeful that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals will do the right thing.
Okay, I've got Jim Skelton with me. I'm going to ask him to join us, Dennis, while we're here. And you might inquire as to Mr. Martinez's relatives and see if they want to talk to us.
I have already asked them, and they prefer not to.
Okay, Jim, this is a little glitch in the come along here. Normally they would cross. At this late stage of the game, there may be a last minute appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
Apparently there must be.
Or it could be a clemency plea.
I would guess Court of Criminal Appeals, but we don't know.
We don't know. And so we don't literally have any idea what's going on.
The only issue, Ray, that could possibly be, from what I've been able to find out, there have been some issues about mental illness involved. And as you well know, we have this real strange notion of competency.
Mm-hmm.
In order to execute somebody, you've got to be competent to be executed, which basically means that you got to have the present ability to understand that you're being executed and why you're being executed. They don't want you to die unless you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only issue that's left out there that's been the issue on writs is whether or not this man is mentally competent.
So we're not talking about mental competency at the time of the crime. We're talking about mental competency as we prepare for execution.
Let me explain how that works. There are about three different things involving mental competency. Number one, you have to be mentally competent to go to trial. That's okay. An entirely different issue. And what that basically means is that you've got to know, number one, have enough ability to be able to communicate with your lawyer and prepare a defense. And number two, you've got to have some rational understanding of the proceedings. That's competency to go to trial, and you've got to be competent to go to trial. Then the next thing that's a brand new thing that's kind of coming out now, a lot of people heretofore have been able to waive right to counsel.
Dennis, are you able to follow this? Dennis?
Yes.
Okay.
And then we have the competency of whether or not you're competent to defend yourself. That's been the Supreme Court ruled on a case recently this term that says just because you're competent to go to trial does not mean you're competent to waive counsel. And they've been kind of clamping down on that, because we've had some real bizarre cases where we had a guy in San Antonio once that defended himself on a death penalty case wearing purple cowboy chaps. And I don't think that would ever happen today, because courts now have gotten pretty strict about competency to defend yourself, being a pro se lawyer. Then the third thing, we talk about competency. In order to execute somebody, and this seems so bizarre, that you have to be competent to realize why you're being executed and understand that you're being executed for a crime that you committed. And the big issue in this case, at least through all the writ hearings, this man suffers with some problems with epilepsy and some problems mentally. And they tried to use this at some of the writ hearings to explain his rage. And the issue on appeal, at least when I've been able to find out, that they've raised some issues about his mental competency, and I'm assuming to be executed is the only thing I can assume.
Well, epilepsy as a defense in a criminal trial, there's case law being developed on that.
It's not really a defense, per se. In order for something to be a defense, it's got to be rise to the level where it becomes legal insanity, where you don't know what you're doing is right or wrong. What they use it for, and what they attempted to use it here, is a mitigating factor. That he is suffering from what they call front lobal epilepsy is what they call it. And there is evidence this man has had a mental problem, heard voices, for example, after this killing occurred. These killings occurred. He ended up in a mental hospital hearing voices.
He was arrested.
Right. Well, he turned himself in and got called the police later. And he heard voices, and they would have used this, they claim, to mitigate, much like voluntary intoxication. It'd be a mitigating factor, but not a defense. Because the only time you can ever have it as a defense, if you have mental defect that renders you incapable of distinguishing right from wrong. It has to be to that level, but it can be used as a mitigating factor.
Dennis, do you want to add to this conversation?
Everything that I've heard is accurate. Everything I've heard is understandable. It's worth noting that his uncles reported to me that since he was little, they knew that something was wrong with him. Sometimes he would be around them, and he was almost as if he was not aware that he was there, which is not uncommon with people who have some kind of epilepsy. We're not talking about people who have grand mal seizures and fall to the ground, but people who just suddenly become aware that they don't know where they are or even who they are.
Yeah, there is a range of symptoms dealing with epilepsy, not all of which is we need to get something in his mouth to keep him from biting his tongue.
Right. And that's apparently the kind of epilepsy that Virgil has, and apparently had for his entire life, from what his uncles are telling me. Interestingly, too, and I don't know, I'll just mention this because it was mentioned to me, that his uncles believe that Virgil actually came upon the murder, and that one of the victims, Frank, I guess Gomez was his name, was that the actual murderer, that Gomez was also mentally unstable, and that he had previously had problems injuring his grandmother. And so the family of Virgil is not only concerned because they believe that their loved one is being executed, but they believe that he's innocent and is the victim of another.
Virgil is the unrelated teenager listed as a victim, right?
Gomez.
Correct.
Virgil Gomez.
Yes.
He was the neighbor, right? He was the 18-year-old neighbor that lived in the same trailer park area where these murders occurred, and according to the state's theory, came to the rescue of the woman being shot, and he was also shot and killed, they claim, by Martinez. So he was really a neighbor that lived in the neighborhood.
Other than Martinez himself, there's no other witnesses?
Well, no. There was a lady that runs the trailer park. She was a witness, and then they had two other additional people who lived nearby. This occurred in a mobile home park.
And interestingly also, the mobile home apparently burned to the ground a couple of days or maybe a week after the crime, and Frank Gomez, the victim.
It's John Gomez.
Father was a former police officer.
Oh, okay.
Again, I'm relating to you what I was told.
What you were told by the family.
One thing
accurate,
what the opinion
that's,
says about...
That's what the family is carrying in their hearts right now.
Okay.
Well, what the opinion says from the Court of Criminal Appeals about this, that was one of the issues brought up on the direct appeal, that John Gomez was a neighbor, and it was one of two things. Either he was over at the lady's house helping her look after her children. He's an 18-year-old person, lived at the mobile home park. And one of the things they tried at the trial level was to introduce evidence of John Gomez, the man that was one of the victims, that he, too, had a criminal record and that he, too, had had a mental illness problem in the past. That was excluded by the trial judge at the trial level. They tried to get this into evidence at the trial itself.
The defense attorney.
Right.
Yeah.
And they excluded it, and the Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the decision, saying it was not admissible. Because as a general rule, the violent nature of a victim of a crime, and that's how he was viewed from a legal viewpoint, that is only going to come into bearing if the defendant's claiming self-defense. Mm-hmm. And they got to do it to show that why he was claiming self-defense. And there never was any claim of self-defense in this case because Martinez claims he didn't do it. So the idea of them getting into the only time you're ever going to get into evidence, the record of a victim of a crime, is usually on a self-defense case. You can get in there by
So this
character.
Is a much more convoluted case.
Convoluted in that sense is, you can have what they call an alternative perpetrator defense, where you're claiming somebody else did it. But what he's basically saying at the trial level, Martinez, is, I didn't do it, I didn't do the killing. And therefore, if he says he didn't do the killing, there's no self-defense issue vis-a-vis Gomez. And if there's no vis-a-vis defense vis-a-vis Gomez, there's no way to get in Gomez's prior
character. Well, in his claim of I didn't do it, did that include he didn't do Gomez?
He didn't do any of it. Here's how the facts ran down according from the statement of facts in the Court of Criminal Appeals. According to the facts given by the court, is that Martinez had been dating a lady in the mobile home park. And she had two children, a 5-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. What happened, they split up. And their relationship broke up. And apparently and the opinion never goes into this, apparently it had been a somewhat stormy relationship, because after they broke up, this lady who had been dating told the lady at the mobile home park, I'm scared of him, he frightens me, if he ever comes over, calls the police.
Okay.
So they'd had a relationship, a dating relationship. So what happened, the way the case broke down from the statement of facts, is the woman who owned the mobile home park, who managed it, living about 50 feet away, one night heard a bunch of noise and screaming coming from the trailer house where the lady lived. She goes over next door, listens in, and she hears the woman inside the hot trailer holler, "No, Virgil, no, Virgil, no, don't." Then she runs to call 911. And when she's calling 911 is when some more of the neighbors come out. And what happened, they claimed they see Martinez shoot his former girlfriend.
Okay.
The children are shot. In fact, he shoots his former girlfriend something like 12 times. Shoots a five-year-old boy something like five times. Shoots a three-year-old girl three or four times. And then apparently John Gomez comes to her rescue and shoots him eight times. And those were all people killed in one transaction, all killed with the same 9mm gun, but they never found the gun. Ever.
Okay, but all of the evidence indicates a single gun.
Everything indicates a single 9mm gun.
Okay, Dennis, is there any movement over there?
Is there any what?
Any movement? Anybody trying to cross the street?
No, we are still all in the same status. Listening to the discussion, his uncles say that he does admit killing John Gomez, but that it was in self-defense. And he took the gun from Gomez and killed Gomez with it, and then panicked and ran and left. And
okay.
So whatever actually happened, I don't think that we will ever know. The state's case, of course, prevailed, and tonight we're standing on the corner in hopes that some greater wisdom, apparently the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals maybe, is even considering stopping this.
Well, and there's some politically interesting things about this case because Elizabeth is back with us. Do you have anything to report?
Yes, a spokesman for the
here.
I spoke with Jason Clark, who's
yes.
in the public information office with TDCJ. He said that apparently there are still appeals pending and that they're in a holding pattern just like we are.
Okay, and I've seen this go both ways. I have seen the appeals pending result in a delay, and I've seen the appeals pending result in a proceeding with the action.
Yes.
So we're in limbo, Dennis.
Yes, we are. But it's better to be in limbo than in mourning.
Absolutely. Can you do this for me? I'm going to cut you loose. Can you call Elizabeth, if anything happens?
Yes, I
because
will if Elizabeth learns anything, can you ask her to call me?
Yes. If we hear anything on this end, we'll be back in touch with you. I know they're not going to hold the media there all night, so the media will either cross the street or they will leave.
Oh, no, the media will be here all night, too. I've been here before, and the media stays, and so if it goes on, they'll be here. If it doesn't, they'll leave when we leave.
Okay. Well, keep us informed, and we'll keep you informed.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire. He's a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. And he is a frequent vigil attendee at the Death House in Huntsville, which is the old Walls unit. Jim.
Yes.
We've pretty much explored that area of the thing. But what about this politics? How does the defense lawyer and now as district attorney change sides in a case?
Get elected a DA.
Get elected DA. That's
real simple. Get more votes than the opponent. What happened in this case, there was a lady in her, and I can never pronounce her name, Yenny. Is that how you pronounce it? She and another lawyer, Stan McGee, were the defense lawyers in this case. And after this case, she became the elected district attorney. And what's real interesting, I was talking to a friend of mine, Bill Leathers, and this has been the last capital case that's ever come out of Brazoria County.
The last capital case?
He said it's the very last capital case that they tried in Brazoria County that they got the death penalty on. The very last one.
And so now the criminal defense lawyer, who's had her name dragged through the appeals.
Well, here's what happened. First off, the case is not quite as cut and dried as people might think, because you have basically three eyewitnesses to the killings. There were four people killed, and the lady that ran the trailer park is a woman named Sherry Graves. She witnessed the killing. A neighbor by the name of Robin Johnstone and her son Keith Burrow came running outside when all the noise was going on. And Keith Burrow claims that he saw Martinez shooting his former girlfriend. That he actually witnessed that. So you have at least one three eyeball witnesses who saw the shooting. You also have a substantial number of shots fired. For example, the girlfriend was shot 14 times.
Mm.
The 5-year-old child named Joshua was shot 5 times.
Mm.
The 3-year-old girl was shot 3 times. And John Gomez, the neighbor, was shot 8 times.
But Jim...
All of these came from the same gun.
All of these came from the same gun.
So whoever killed Gomez, according to the ballistics, also killed the other three.
That had formed a pattern of behavior by the time he got around to Gomez.
And they never did find the murder weapon. But what they did find when what happened after the shootings occurred, Martinez takes off to Del Rio.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, he calls up the police under a different name and claims he's hearing voices and hearing voices telling him to kill people. He gets put in a psychiatric ward. That's when they discover that he'd given a false name. They trace him down to the murderers. They get a search warrant, search the mother's house, and they found a clip to a 9mm gun, same sort of clip that was used in this particular weapon, and they found a box where a 9mm gun had been stored or kept. Never found the gun, but they did find a clip in his mother's house that had held 15 rounds, so whoever shot used a clip and reloaded a couple of times at least to shoot that many times. And so what happened, they have that information. They have at least three eyeball witnesses present. And also, they ask Gomez, who is dying, who's got shot 8 times, who did this? And he kept saying, ex-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend. So you got the dying declaration of one of the victims involved in it. You've got three eyeball witnesses. You've got one gun, according to ballistics, that did all the killings.
Okay.
So if his defense is that he killed Gomez in self-defense, and there's also three other people that got killed. Now, what happened during the trial itself, they never used the fact that he suffered this form of epilepsy as a child as any type of mitigating evidence. So what happened?
Well, now, this was in 1996.
Right.
And that's when the shooting happened. The trial happened either later that year or early the next year.
Right.
And how well developed in 96 was this special epilepsy claim as a defense?
Apparently it's fairly well developed because the reports that what had happened in federal court, they filed a writ claiming the lawyers were ineffective in federal court for not bringing this up. And from reading the petitions in federal court, they saying that the defense lawyers did not review his history of epilepsy. So apparently he'd been documented for some time. But the reason they didn't use it is what they said, that it also brought forth a lot more bad information. And they were real concerned. In fact, the magic words that she used the defense lawyer used, the magic words that she used is that when the doctors examined her, they said this made him have uncontrollable acts of aggression and anger toward people. And she was fearful that had the jury known about this, that he had this problem that caused him to have this anger and aggression, it would be evidence of future dangerousness. And that's what she was real worried about. Because you couldn't talk about his epilepsy history without going into the fact he was going to be dangerous in the future, too. And it's one of those things, the Fifth Circuit talks about a two-edged sword. When you have a problem that a person has that makes him aggressive and angry and uncontrollable, you can explain why he did it, but by the same token, you're also explaining he's going to be real dangerous in the future if you don't do something about it. And so what happened, they made a value judgment that we're going to leave the epilepsy alone because it drug bad evidence in as well as good evidence. And the magic...
And that's a perfectly legitimate decision for a criminal defense lawyer to make.
You would
have to weigh the positive and the negative aspects of any evidence that you brought in to a capital trial.
Absolutely. In fact, the way they described it, and these are the doctor's own words, that he had savage, uncontrolled aggressiveness caused by this problem with epilepsy. So when you prove up the reason he did it is because of that, you're also plowing the same field as saying this guy is extremely
dangerous. He's going to continue to be...
That's right.
Yeah.
And that just scares people to death because especially in juries, when they've already been convicted of killing four people, And you said the reason he did it because of this problem. He had an epileptic problem that makes him this way. That means he's going to be that way when he leaves the courtroom that day. And it scares the holy heck out of people. And the magic word they use, at least in legal opinion, it's a double-edged sword. It cuts two ways. It explains your conduct, but also it gives real fertile ground for someone to argue they're a danger in the future and therefore should be removed from society. And it's a value judgment, and that's exactly what the defense lawyers did. They said it's best not to go into that.
I think it's very interesting that this is the last capital case that Brazoria County has tried. I can understand the economics of it, but the amount of shooting that happened in this case, but that alone means this is not an ordinary case. Or unless, I don't know anything about guns. Is a 9mm gun kind of like a BB gun?
That's above a 38 and below a 45.
It's above a 38 and below a 45. So that's a very serious weapon.
It's a real common gun. It's a 9mm, if I'm not mistaken. It's the kind of gun usually used, the kind of shell used in an AR-15. It's a pretty potent weapon.
And a single shell from a 9mm would do some serious damage.
And we're talking about a lot of shooting.
And so if you shot somebody 14 times, you're talking about 14 entrance wounds and probably at least 12 or 13 exit wounds, depending on where the bones were.
Especially when you're shooting small children.
Right.
That makes it even more egregious.
We got Dave?
We've got Dennis. We've got Dennis Longmire on the line, the first witnesses have crossed the street.
Oh, okay. Dennis.
Yes. The witnesses for Virgil are now literally walking in the door of the walls unit. About a minute and a half ago, the witnesses for the media walked in. So
the process has begun.
Clearly the process has begun, and whatever appeals were pending did not succeed. It's gotten very quiet on the corner. We were, for a few moments, very hopeful that we were going to have another productive evening, but apparently it's not.
Well, I appreciate your calling and keeping us informed with that, and get back in touch, or we'll get back in touch with you as soon as the process is cycled through.
Okay.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, apparently the process has begun on Virgil Martinez. The appeals held things up but did not stop things. Witnesses have crossed the street, and according to the ritual we use when we execute people, the witness crossed the street, they go into the building, they are conduited somehow to the death chamber, and the process proceeds from there. So whatever appeals were before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, at least several enough judges to continue have gone that way, and that's really not a surprise, is it?
No. When they talk about having significant mental problems, you can be significantly mentally ill but still be competent to receive the death penalty. And just the fact that you're mentally ill, that within itself is not sufficient to get away from the death penalty.
You got to be mentally ill to a degree at each of these levels.
Right. Like I said earlier, you've got to be aware why you're being executed. You know, if you think you're going to go to the McDonald's for lunch and they're going to execute you, they want you to know why you're dying. And the fact that he's suffering some sort of mental illness is not going to be anything to make him not competent to be executed.
And sometimes that doesn't work. I remember one of the criminal defense lawyers who dealt specifically. Friend of the prison shows, Winston Cochran. One of his clients had saved something to eat after they got through.
There was a case in Florida much like that. And, you know, we've changed. We're slowly trying to get more, if you can call it being civilized when you kill people. At least we're trying to be a little bit more civilized about it. And a lot of these executions I don't think would be carried through today. There was a deal once in Florida where they were going to execute a guy. He wanted to hold what he was doing until he got back. He wasn't aware of the fact when he's leaving the cell that he wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. Here you've got to be. In fact, the big issue, and this is one of those that's bouncing around the federal system, we got a guy, I believe it's in Pennsylvania, somewhere on the East Coast, that's mentally ill. And when he takes medication, he's okay.
Yeah.
And what happens, and here's the big issue on appeal, can you make a guy take medication to make him sane enough so you can kill him?
I remember the discussion around that case. And what was the conclusion?
Well, they haven't resolved that case yet, because his lawyer's saying, don't take the pills, don't get sane.
Yeah, don't get sane.
And they interviewed him, I believe it was on 60 Minutes, they interviewed this gentleman that did the killing. It was a real grotesque killing that he committed. And you could tell by talking to him that he was, a bubble off plum. And so the big question is, can you force a person to take medication to be sane long enough to execute them? That's the big issue. They haven't resolved that yet.
And they're not likely to resolve it. Because how do you resolve something like that?
I mean, it just seems bizarre, doesn't it?
Who is the deity-like person who comes in and says, oh, we're going to go this way, right?
Well, the guy who messed up the presidential oath. To answer your question.
Actually, literally him.
Yeah.
We're actually having a few laughs here on the execution watch, which you may think is inappropriate. But the fact of the matter is that if you're listening from somewhere else, this is very common procedure in Texas. Jim Skelton and I do this a lot, don't we?
More than I want to.
Did you, when we started this, did your business got good quick, didn't it?
Well, I didn't realize when you called me up and asked me to do some research for you, I thought, well, maybe a couple of times. I didn't realize we're doing it two and three times a week almost.
It is pretty heavy, but I want the listeners to know that Jim thoroughly researches not just what happened in these cases, but also the legal history, which is much more complicated, and frequently to a degree that I wouldn't even understand it if Jim weren't here to explain it to us. Let me see who we got. Dave on the line. Dave, this is Ray. Well, we received word from Dennis in Huntsville that, I'd say about 6:25, the witnesses crossed the road.
Okay.
And that means the process is continuing. There was considerable delay in this case. We suspect that the delay was around Mr. Martinez's mental competence to be executed.
Right, probably so.
Well, where are you and what's going on?
Well, corner of Westheimer and Shepherd again. We had didn't have a very big group out there today. There were three of us, and we had a couple of people that are normally there that are both sick and didn't want to come out in the colder air. So there were three of us, but the way I look at it, three is better than none, and we get a lot of response to what we're doing, and so we're in good shape. Ray, this thing about I might have mentioned this before, the mental illness. I think we've got a lot more people up there who are mentally ill and severely mentally ill than we have any idea about, because we get letters every now and then. We have a list. The Texas Coalition keeps a list of the people that we know of who are seriously mentally ill. But we'll get a letter from somebody on death row every now and then that it just shows that the person is not really with it. And, I'm not awfully familiar with the Martinez, but I think there's a lot of that up there, and nobody has really looked at it carefully enough yet. And,
Jim Skelton here with me in the studio is explaining that this is not as simple. I used to think that mental competence had to do with what your mental condition was at the time of the crime. And he said, no, that's one step. I mean, that's an issue in the trial. But even before you have a trial, you have to be mentally competent to stand trial and assist your defense.
Right.
And then they can't execute you if you're not mentally competent to be executed. You got to know what's going on.
Right, there's two parts.
So there's actually three parts. There's the time of the crime, there's the time of the trial, and then there's the time of the execution.
Right. And one of the other things which a lot of people don't understand is that back in, I guess it was 2003, 1973, I think, when the Supreme Court excluded people who are mentally retarded from the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
That mental retardation is tied into your IQ. The only thing that they have when it comes to mental illness is these questions about competency and whether somebody is been declared insane, which means, and that's a legal term. Of course, Jim knows all about this. This is a legal term. Whether you knew the difference between right and wrong, and thing right now that excludes somebody who is, say, paranoid, schizophrenic, bipolar, severe depression, and any of those things, even brain damage.
There is no correlationship between the legal term mental competence and the scientific term mental competence.
Right.
Those two are different genres and different arenas.
Yeah. And you know, somebody might, this came up with Andrea Yates, somebody might, at one level you could say they knew the difference between right and wrong, but it doesn't, be, but their mental state could be such that, you know, they weren't fully in control of what they were doing because of their mental illness. And this is something that is lingering out there. Some people think it could be the next step that the Supreme Court might take, that if you had somebody where it was diagnosed that they were paranoid schizophrenic, for example, that they might be excluded from the death penalty. But that
But I also remember friends of mine from the Cure Board, Lois and Ken's son,
right,
who was diagnosed, treated, and everything else, and between hospitals and off medication, did this horrible thing, and they ultimately executed him, even though they had all that diagnostic history.
Ray, I'm going to jump in and mention something.
Jim's going to join the conversation.
I want to mention something. We had a case that gives a little glimmer of hope that came out about a month.
Speak up just a little bit. Yeah. I can't hear you here.
I don't know what I'm speaking directly in the microphone.
Yeah, he's got to go to the microphone here.
We had a case involving diminished responsibility that we've been working on for a long time and finally got a little bit of breathing room. Let me explain what happened. There was a man that was delusional and thought he was shooting at Muslims, claimed they were Muslims, or they got all excited about Muslims, end up being policemen. And the courts ruled that although he wasn't mentally ill, he was entitled to a lesser included offense because he couldn't formulate the intent to kill the police officers. He thought they were Muslims. And so in this case, they said they at least acknowledged what we call diminished capacity to form a part of a culpable mental state. Well, basically, for example, if I shoot at you, that's one offense. But if I shoot at you knowing you're a policeman, the offense is greater.
Yeah.
In this case, he's shooting at policemen, but he's delusional thinking he's shooting at Muslims.
So his level of culpability shifts.
Right. So his level of culpability went down one. And guess what? Our Court of Appeals reversed the case, so they didn't submit an issue on the culpable mental state. So we're getting some breathing room on what we call diminished capacity, which is not quite insanity. It just simply knocks out a certain level of culpability.
Would that apply to the Martinez case?
Wouldn't apply here.
Would not apply here.
Because, again, the Martinez case involved an instance where they were going to use that to mitigate. It wouldn't reduce capital, because the reason this became a capital murder, you kill more than four people during one transaction.
Yeah.
That would never reduce it down to a straight murder.
Sure.
That's the problem. Would never have helped here.
Dave, we're going to get, we have someone from Austin on the line to get on the air.
Okay, good.
But thanks,
Ray, and thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
Appreciate all of you.
Thank you. This is an evolving situation that will continue to evolve. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, you take care.
Bye-bye. And now we have Kristen Hule.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? Hule?
Yes, Hule.
Hule. And tell us who you're with.
I'm the executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
And you are in Austin?
Yes.
And are you familiar with this case?
Just a little bit. I mean, I think I'm going to speak more generally about.
Are you aware that we delayed
Yes, I've been listening.
Okay, this execution for a while, and the conversation here is boiling down to mental competency, apparently at three stages of the evolution of the case.
Mm-hmm.
Are we the only people talking about these things, or is this a conversation going on elsewhere?
No, actually, this is an emerging issue in around the country. In fact, three states have introduced legislation this year that would calls for a prohibition on the death penalty for severely mentally ill offenders. So legislators in Indiana, Kentucky, and North Carolina are poised to consider legislation that would end this practice and would address the gaps that exist currently.
And the Texas legislature is just beginning its new session,
right,
which lasts 5 months every 2 years.
Exactly. And we're waiting with bated breath to hear what the committee assignments are going to be, because our goal this year is to secure a legislative committee hearing on a bill that would end the death penalty altogether.
What committee would that go to?
I would go to the House Criminal Jurisprudence Committee. I believe, though, that's going to be combined with law enforcement this session.
Okay, you've got a little committee incest going on there. and in the Senate would be the Jurisprudence Committee?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we suspect that's going to be Whitmire again.
Whitmire's in the Senate.
Yeah, he's in the Senate.
Right, so we're looking at a House committee.
Okay, so the only chair we're not reasonably certain of, and I don't guess we're certain of Whitmire until the lieutenant governor makes his appointments.
Right, but no committee assignments have been made in the House of Representatives, and that's where the bill will be going.
Yeah,
it's been introduced. It's House Bill 682, sponsored by Houston Representative Jessica Farrar.
Okay.
And so none of the committee assignments in the House have been made. But it was previously chaired by a Pena.
Aha.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's coming from Jessica this time.
Mm-hmm.
And it will go to that committee. To give you some idea how far I'm out of it, the last chair of that committee I knew was Alan Place, and he's been out of the legislature almost a decade.
They haven't done a lot. That's favorable to us, have they?
Do you think that what is your concern about progressive legislation affecting death penalty under the new speaker?
I think we have a sense that there will be greater openness to debate, and that's really our first step, is to get the members of the House of Representatives to at least engage in dialogue and debate on this issue, gather public and invited testimony, and, you know, at least have an open discussion about whether or not the death penalty is in fact necessary to the state of Texas to promote public safety.
We've got listeners out here that may not be as familiar with the Texas legislature as you and I, but the fact of the matter is, getting a fair hearing of your issue,
mm-hmm,
is in itself an accomplishment, whether that is favorably received or not.
Absolutely. I mean, on the surface it sounds like a very modest goal, but in fact it would be quite an achievement to secure a hearing, as we are seeking. I mean, and not just in Texas, but around the country, it's been very difficult for abolition bills to get any sort of serious consideration by their respective state legislators.
Well, building a record gives you an opportunity to have data to fall back on,
mm-hmm,
in future sessions of the legislature, because you're in it for the long haul, right?
Absolutely. We are working to put ourselves out of business, but we know that's not going to happen for a few more years.
How familiar are you with these efforts in other states? You've mentioned it a couple of times. Are you following that?
Yes, I actually just attended the annual conference of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, so I was able to hear from my colleagues in other states about their own legislative efforts. And I'm happy to report that we think we have a really good shot of abolishing the death penalty in states, including Maryland and New Mexico.
Well, when you're up at these national gatherings, you're kind of the redheaded stepchild, because more of that happens here than anywhere else.
Yes, everyone feels quite sorry for us.
But as we say that, there's still some people who are receptive to those ideas in the legislature, although they may not be the majority of any given committee and certainly not of the floors.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Texas legislators are coming to reflect the concerns of their constituents about the fairness and reliability of our criminal justice system overall. And so issues related to potential innocence and just the sheer cost of the death penalty are starting to resonate, I think, among legislators, although there's quite a bit more education that needs to be done.
What can listeners of this program do to help your work?
Well, we are a statewide grassroots membership organization, so we are always eager for new people to join our organization as members. We have an annual conference ourselves taking place in February here in Austin. It will be Saturday, February 21st, at the Family Life Center of the First United Methodist Church in downtown Austin. And more details.
And if people didn't know, that's literally right across the street from the Capitol building.
Yes, you can see the Capitol Dome from the conference room. So we're excited to have that reminder of what we're doing and why we're there. The conference is going to feature Celeste Fitzgerald, who was instrumental in the successful effort to repeal the death penalty in New Jersey. There will also be a number of workshops aimed at educating our members on how they can become effective advocates at the Texas legislature and help us, you know, move this bill, this abolition bill, forward. We'll also have workshops on how to communicate effectively about the death penalty and how to work with victims' family members, among many others.
How do people get in touch with your organization?
I would encourage folks to visit our website, and that address is www.tcadp.org. You can also contact our state office, which is based here in Austin, and that number is 512-441-1808. We would love to hear from you.
Okay, now, again, the website is the first letters of Texas Coalition Abolish Death Penalty.
Correct.
TCADP.org. O-R-G. Mm-hmm. And the telephone number again?
That number is 512-441-1808.
And I'm talking to Kristen Houlet, who is the new executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who is working in Austin on that issue, and we appreciate your fine work, and thank you for being a guest on Execution Watch.
Oh, thank you, Ray. It's nice to talk to you again, although not under ideal circumstances.
And not ideal. Are you following our broadcast? Do you?
Yes, I was.
Okay, and so we appreciate your being out there in the audience, and we will have you back as a guest. And if you have any good news, or if you have any disappointments in the legislature, we'll be interested in carrying them to our specialized interest audience.
Great. Thank you so much, Ray.
Thank you, ma'am. And that was Kristen Houlet, and we thank all the guests on the prison. But we're back to me and Jim. And, Jim, we got about 10 minutes of show left here, uh-huh. And I don't know if we're going to get a final answer from Huntsville at this point.
No, because of the delay. Again, you know, at least it gives you some hope, because we're beginning, you know, we're the old idea of not knowing right from wrong as being the standard to execute, my God, should be done away with for years, because back when we first started that concept, our development about mental illness was, we've learned so much more since then. You would think that we'd certainly catch up to date on it, because, and see, the problem from a defense viewpoint, here's a real problem, it's that two-edged sword again. When you explain people's conduct for being mentally ill, then you're basically telling a jury that's already predisposed to kill somebody.
Sure. You qualify the jury so that...
Yeah, because the audience you're talking to have already said under oath they could consider taking somebody's life if they thought they'd be a danger in the future. That's the test. So it's not the general public you're talking to. You're talking about 12 people on a jury who've already said ahead of time that under the right circumstances, if they believe a man's a danger in the future, a woman's a danger in the future, they can execute them. So then you prove up a person's got a severe mental illness. See, that cuts two ways. because when you say they've got a severe mental illness, to explain that conduct, much like the defense lawyers faced here, you're also proving by the same token and breath that they're going to be a danger in the future. Now, you can always say, well, if you medicate them, they're going to be okay. Well, what if they don't take their medication? So, see, that cuts two ways, and that's been one of those real treacherous things and lawyers have to handle. And I felt real sorry for the lawyers in this case because they had a real Hobson's choice.
Yeah.
Because to explain his conduct, they also had to explain that he's very likely to be somebody who could have the same repeat angry, aggressive, out-of-control behavior in the future. And no one, and it's kind of like that old, in fact, the most effective death argument from the prosecution I've ever heard was a lawyer named Don Lambright. He used to got up, and what he would use is an analogy. You've got a real good dog that watches sheep, but this sheepdog started getting a taste for killing sheep. And to protect the rest of the flock, it breaks your heart, but you've got to eliminate your sheepdog. And it was a devastating argument, because basically what he was saying, you know, we don't really want to do this. But we can't afford to let the rest of the flock be endangered by this person that's defective. And see, that is where your problem comes in with mental illness from a defense viewpoint, because when you prove that up, you're proving you've got a product that is not going to get better in the future in all likelihood. As a matter of fact, will probably with time get worse. And so that is a strong, strong, strong incentive to execute somebody. And I think that should be taken out of the hands of juries. And the truth of the matter is, what we've had a lot of forward-thinking people thinking that instances involving people who commit horrible, heinous acts like this, that that should be in the hand of professional people who know how to handle this and not as opposed to a group of people who react emotionally. Because that argument of the sheepdog protecting the flock is just devastating to an average juror.
Well, the lawyer in this case, the defense lawyer in this case, actually was accused of being incompetent by appellate court.
Absolutely.
How seriously do lawyers take such applications?
Truthfully, in death penalty cases, you get kind of used to them because it's interesting, as I've said before in this program, it's very few people are in jail because of their conduct. They're in jail because their lawyer's a fool. That's always the argument. Now, back when they first started the death penalty again, we had guys like Joe Cannon, who's now dead, and some more of these dodos that they used to appoint all the time that are no longer being appointed on death penalty cases. That's
well, Joe
changed.
Died, but but you wouldn't have noticed the difference in some of his trials.
Someone can say, how could you tell if he's dead or not? And the truth of the matter is, most of the lawyers today who do death penalty cases have been trained fairly well. We've got all sorts of training programs now available. We don't seek a death penalty as often as we used to. Lawyers are more competent now than they've been before. The problem is that the law that we're given to work with is extremely difficult because it's predisposed to kill somebody. It would be much like trying to give somebody a piece of hamburger meat and you'd be the greatest surgeon in the world. You can't make Sophia Loren out of it. I don't care how talented you are, how hard you can suture. And there's no trial that's ever, ever going to be error-free. For example, in this case, you have evidence that you could have mitigated by showing he had an epileptic problem, but that same evidence shows he could be a danger in the future. You've got to make a value judgment as your trial lawyer. And you got to give them some leeway, and they have to evaluate whether or not this is going to work one way or the other. It's like a wave. You have a wave, you have an undertow that can drown you. And that's a value judgment that a lawyer makes. And then you have people later on down the road, like writ lawyers, who claim you've done the worst thing they could possibly do. Well, they're not the ones sitting in the driver's seat. And these two lawyers, I know both of them. And they did as good a job as you can do with this set of facts. Now, what happened when they claimed he was incompetent? They claimed they were incompetent for not developing this issue at a mitigation punishment. The way that was developed was in front of a federal magistrate in Galveston. And let me explain how that works. A district court judges appoint a series of lawyers called magistrates. And what these magistrates basically do is handle preliminary things. And it's like setting bonds. It's kind of like a federal JP, for want of a better phrase.
And so, they're appointed not for life, but for...
Well, they're appointed by the district judge is basically for life, unless you're really a fool, you're going to stay in for life.
Okay.
And so the federal judges appoint the magistrates.
Yeah.
And so what happens when the Fifth Circuit first got this case, And the issue of the lawyers being not being competent for not raising up this issue of his mental illness. When that came up, they had a hearing in front of the magistrate. Magistrate heard all the testimony, and he recommended that the relief be granted, that the lawyers were not competent for not developing this issue. District court judge agreed with the magistrate. But the problem is, that's not the way the federal system works. The federal system works, they don't review the case all over again. The issue on a federal appeal is whether or not the state court gave you a fair and complete hearing, mm-hmm. and whether the holding of the state court is so against federal law that it should be reversed. It's not whether you agree or disagree, it's whether or not you got a fair hearing. And they said that was a trial strategy. That was certainly reasonable to exclude that testimony because it also carried with it that two-edged sword that would give people incentive to give the death penalty. Therefore, as trial strategy, they were not incompetent. And I don't think it hurt. Obviously, it didn't hurt the defense lawyer because she was later elected district attorney, so obviously it did. I'm sure it hurt
her feelings.
It didn't hurt.
You're okay. Dennis, you're back with us now. Dennis, what's happened?
Okay, all of the witnesses have now come back out of the walls unit, which is the signal to us that the execution is over. In fact, Virgil's family, his two uncles who were here, have gone to the car, and some of the rest of the other people who are here with me have all dispersed because of the cold weather up here. And so it is now over. So once again, I guess, this is number 5 this year.
Yeah, we're racking up some numbers here. We got another one scheduled for tomorrow night.
Yes, we do.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for standing by with us. I wish you had better news. We all had some hope here for the delay, but when that didn't pan out, the process is usually pretty efficient.
Yes, I'm glad I could be of help.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
And that was Professor bye-bye, and that was Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University. He teaches criminal justice there, and these issues are important enough for him to take his time and his comfort to go outside the death chamber on this cold night. It's cold in Houston, as Dave reported earlier. All you got to do is open the front door, and you realize that. But it is even colder in Huntsville because Huntsville is to the north from here. We've been having conversations here with Jim Skelton about some general notions about mental health and competency of attorneys. Jim, you can't make a living in capital work.
No. The thing is, Ray, I've done capital cases, and I don't know of any lawyer in town that wants to do them. They absolutely hate them. Normally because, again, you're given almost an impossible task, and you're given so little tools to equip, to work with, and whenever you try your best, and you're always being accused of being incompetent at the end,
yeah.
And it's real discouraging.
Why do they do it? Is it an obligation that goes with their profession? You got into this business to do things, represent people aggressively, and you just get the knocks.
Part of what the reason that you're a criminal defense lawyer is that you have, and Marvin Teague said it years and years ago, he paralleled a criminal defense lawyer to kind of like the old-time gun shooter in town that comes to town, to, you know, the old-time gunslinger. And a part of it, and I know this sounds horrible to say, but a part of it just the challenge of taking on an impossible task. That's a part of it. And I think there's a kind of a deep, abiding dislike of the system that you think it's unfair. Because you take a case like this. Let's assume this guy had a mental illness problem in the very beginning. He had no control over that, and we're killing for something he has no control over, and that's fine. We find that offensive and try to stop it.
Amazing conversation. I'm glad to have you with us. Refer your friends to our archive. I'm Ray Hill. I can't improve upon Jim Skelton's closing words. Jim Skelton, our legal expert, is again tonight. I want to thank Christian Houlet for being on. Of course, Dave Atwood and Dennis Longmire out in the cold. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Stein, who makes all this possible, and it wouldn't not be possible without Otis McClay. The theme music tonight, Death by Texas, was written and recorded by Victoria Panetti. I am Ray Hill. Good night.